Thomas Cronin is one of America's leading students of the presidency. He's written or edited 10 books, including The State of the Presidency, Rethinking the Presidency, and most recently in 89, The Invention of the American Presidency. He is currently a visiting fellow at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and the Hoover Institution. He is also the McHugh Professor of American Institutions and Leadership at the Colorado College in Colorado Springs. For KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, this is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Welcome, Dr. Cronin.
Thank you
for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
My first question is a curiosity. It seems to me that at the very least, every election campaign time, you hear people, whether on the street or in the media, bemoaning the state of leadership in this country. Oh, well, Dukakis is all right, or Bush is all right, or Reagan or Mondale, but they're not the leaders that we seem to envision for ourselves. This is a more complex question than the simple one offered, but is there a dearth of leadership in this country, or are we imaging the wrong thing for what we've got in front of us?
America, Susan, is in many respects designed to not have a central leader leading us, the almost chosen people, to the almost promised land, to paraphrase something that Abraham Lincoln one time said. Our system is designed to have many, many leaders, but not one singular leader. We had a singular leader in the 1760s named George III, and we had a war against having a king or a monarch. And the war was all about having committees of people in neighborhoods and states run their own affairs rather than royal governors and kings. And to some extent, it's kind of disappointing that Americans whine and bellyache from time to time about, you know, goodness sakes, isn't it too bad we don't have a super leader or superman or a super person in our White House or in our governor's office to lead us to some promised land. That's not the way the founders of this country wanted it to be, and it's not really how Americans want it to be, in my view. I think that people have to realize that ours is a very Madisonian system and very much a system of dispersed leadership, decentralized leadership. And we don't want a lot of power to be located in government, or certainly not in the White House, or in the governor's or mayor's office or borough chief offices or whatever. We want to have a nation of citizen leaders, and that's hard to make work, and it's hard to bring into practice. But I think that those who argue, well, too bad that Ronald Reagan or Michael Dukakis or whoever isn't up to being our supreme leader, are people who misunderstand the mission, if you will, and the vision of the America that most of us want it to be, which is a nation in which there are large, large numbers, I mean, 50,000, 500,000 people who ought to be leading, rather than a singular person or a singular institution. The vitality of America, in my view, Susan, is very much wrapped up in the vitality of non-governmental America and regional America, rather than from on high.
Do we still whine, as you say, about the missing leader because the problems are so many, so complex, so huge?
The quick fix. I think a lot of American people want a silver bullet. They want a quick fix. We have an impatience and restlessness, just like people in any nation. And we kind of misunderstand the nature of democracy. We would wish that things were simple and that if only we had a special kind of leader, a charismatic kind of gifted leader, that we would be blessed by having the responsibility taken on her or his back, rather than have to be things that we have to work out. And
but we'd probably hate him if we had that man or that woman, wouldn't we?
Well, that's what happens. In fact, when we get a strong leader like Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln, or we get strong grassroots leaders like Martin King, we often kill them, just like Joan of Arc was burned to the stake. We have a strong leadership in any society often breeds a dependency, a weakness. There's an old aphorism that I'm fond of that goes, strong leaders make for a weak people. And America doesn't want a weak people. And therefore, we're suspicious about strong leadership. Yet we need it. Ironically, even the founding of our country, we were dependent on George Washington and a few of his generals to be key leaders in winning the war against the Brits and the British. And just recently, not long ago, we looked to and we empowered, if you will, George Bush and his generals to be leaders on behalf of our national interests in the Gulf War. So there are, from time to time, emergencies that arise. The recession of the 1930s after the 1929 economic crash was another example where we were dependent and we looked for a strong leader. But in normal times, and usually, we would like to have leadership dispersed and we would like to have a president, a Congress, and governments in general limited so that they can basically carry out our wishes rather than carry out their own wishes.
You're listening to Conversations. This is Dr. Thomas Cronin. Once again, he's currently a visiting scholar at Stanford University Graduate School of Business and the Hoover Institution, and he is the McHugh Professor of American Institutions and Leadership at the Colorado College in Colorado Springs. He'll be the acting president of that university as of this fall. It seems to me that we also have, if we have a situational leader, George Bush in the Persian Gulf, we also have leaders of a different sort. I wonder if you agree with this. It seems to me that Jimmy Carter is now, in his post-presidential period, the conscience of the nation in some ways, or in some ways a conscience of the world. He works very hard on human rights, civil rights. He builds low-income housing. He mediates between disgruntled world leaders. He travels to watch elections. In some ways, is he a leader of a specific area of our lives?
Absolutely, Susan. I think that a lot of different types of people can perform a whole variety of leadership, and consciousness-raising leadership and leadership of compassion, leadership of witness and example, whether it's Mother Teresa or former President Jimmy Carter or Ralph Nader or an environmentalist or somebody who wants, like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, who stands up for some principle and wants tougher penalties against drunk alcoholic driving and so on. I think there are a large number of people who play a moral leadership role, a consciousness-raising role, and that's important too. We need a very broad-gauge definition of what leadership is all about. Leaders, in my judgment, are people who make things happen, make good things happen that otherwise would not happen, and help to prevent things from happening that otherwise would happen. They're people who mobilize people and resources to bring about positive results and get groups to tackle projects and problems that they didn't think that they could tackle and to tackle them and move an enterprise forward. Leaders are people also in different situations who help define and defend and promote values that are important. And so we need leaders. Some leaders are clarifiers of choices. Some leaders are excellent administrators and managers. Some leaders are excellent fundraisers. Others are help to provide the vision and the morale, and they're great motivators. Very few of us have all the skills of leadership. Most of us are specialists in administration or in writing or in communicating and so on. But to make a community effective, you need people who will clarify the choices for community. You need other people who run political parties and election processes. You'll need other people who will be judges, and you need other people who will be remind us of what we can become and can motivate us on to being better than and to play to our strongest strengths. So Jimmy Carter, certainly in my judgment, is a leader. I think writers can be leaders. I think Rachel Carlson and Harriet Beecher Stowe were formidable leaders at pointing out problems in their day. I think that critics of government, whether they be Henry David Thoreau or Alexander Solzhenitsyn, can be formidable and critical leaders.
Is there a chance that we miss seeing those leaders in this country because of the high-glitz media that surrounds leadership? What we see when we watch the news on the television is a fairly polished performance. Well, most of the people who are raising the idea at a city council meeting are not giving a stellar performance.
That's right. There are all kinds of leaders. They come in all different shapes. Fidel Castro and Margaret Thatcher don't look alike. Mother Teresa and Daniel Rostenkowski in the Congress don't look alike. And some leaders aren't very good speakers, but their life is an example. Jimmy Carter was never much of a speaker. Ronald Reagan was, but Jimmy Carter right now by some of his negotiation work and concern about human rights is carrying out by example. He's a leader of thought and ideals. So, yes, leaders come in every different shape. Some are impressive and some are unimpressive. Some lead by example and others by quiet deed and action tend to lead. Some are glitzy and appear and meet the press and are in People's Magazine and on the Larry King Show and your show and so on. And others, in their own quiet way, make a contribution. A good example, a contrast to this a few years ago in France would have been Charles de Gaulle, who was a larger-than-life general and president of France in the 1950s and 60s. And at the very same time that he was an elected and galvanizing, charismatic leader, and he looked like a leader with his medals and his tall personality, strong views, there was a man much shorter than he who never was elected to anything, a man by the name of Jean Monnet. And he, in his own quiet way as a businessman and leader, began to get the countries of Europe to talk with one another about building an economic community and talking about their differences and commonalities and common vision. And he, in many respects, is the father of the economic, the European economic and political communities that now, a generation later, is coming into existence. And he was the father of that. Well, he, in the long run, will have a greater impact on Europe than Charles de Gaulle. And yet you wouldn't have known that then, and if there was a popularity contest or on the cover of Time magazine or the equivalent in France, Jean Monnet would have rarely got the attention, whereas Charles de Gaulle was the out-front public leader. So I think that is important.
It doesn't matter, then, if some leaders aren't seen.
That's correct. The leadership of ideas and ideals and behind-the-scenes leadership can be just as compelling in the long run. Some of the great writers in the world have had an enormous impact after they've died. Writers such as Sophocles and Shakespeare and so on, by the legacy they have left us about ideas, about authority and power and influence and leadership and how they can write and make us think about our values and who we are and the human condition can be great. Let me add a different dimension to this, Susan. And it follows up, I think, nicely on what you were talking about a moment ago. I have a little theory borrowed from theater called kind of an Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 stages of leadership. In Act 1, I argue there are agitators and stir-uppers and troublemakers, people like John Brown at Harper's Ferry, people like Karl Marx and his Communist Manifesto, people perhaps like Patrick Henry and his treasonous speech in the House of Burgess, people like Jesus Christ with his novel religious ideas. And later on, in Act 2, you get leaders who build organizations and grassroots movements, and they temper the ideas of these Christ-like figures, if you will, or Marx-like figures, and they become the Lenins or the apostles and the disciples, but they build momentum and enlarge the ranks of people who care about the beliefs of people, and they in turn will lobby and educate those who are in positions of power in the establishment, if you will. The establishment people I refer to as Act 3 people, and they are people who have high responsibility but are fear to take risks. They're like the popes, if you will, or like the Stalins or the Gorbachevs, who have to balance all the contending forces. If in the American Revolution, for example, you had Patrick Henry first, and then you later had Thomas Jefferson in Act 2, and then John Adams and Alexander Hamilton in Act 3. And in every period of American history, you have issues which need galvanizing agitators first, and then tempering movements to be built around that, and long periods where you need Susan Anthony's to campaign for ideas and so on. And then later, the people in elective office or party positions will translate that into law or Supreme Court decisions or regulations of government and so on.
This is very much how the civil rights movement.
Yes, yes, indeed. And the environmental rights movement and tax reform movements and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, all these movements, left, right, and in the middle, come about not in a day or in a month or in a year, but usually over several years, several decades, sometimes several generations, where there's a and my point is that it requires all kinds of leaders. Sometimes there are rabble-rousing leaders, and others there are people who organize, and others are who know how to write laws and so on. But leaders are dependent on other leaders. And there is no one leader for all acts or all seasons, to, if you will, or all scenes. Our society, the United States, requires all kinds of leaders. And I think we need to have a greater tolerance of the fact that leadership is not a top-down, where leader X gets elected to high post and all of a sudden she or he writes laws on a tablet that get handed down and we the people follow and as passive spectators follow blindly the tablets from on high. That's not really what a democracy is all about. It's not what America is at all alike. Occasionally in a Cuban missile crisis or a Gulf crisis, presidents have to act, you know, independent from the people in some respects, and they lead the people rather than the people leading them. But that's the exception to the rule. I think on most social and economic and moral issues, in the United States, the American people point out the direction in broad general terms in which they want their leaders to lead. And that's the way it ought to be.
And what's the state of the health of the democracy in terms of many leaders and a three-act play?
I think we need to do a better job of educating young people in America and everyone in America to the recognition that they have leadership responsibilities too, that the act of electing mayors, governors, and presidents and feeling relieved of our responsibility and dumping responsibility or fixing responsibility onto people solely in public life or in top positions in corporations and universities for that matter too, that ends our responsibility. That's not the way it ought to be. That's not the way it can be.
Are we doing that too much?
We are. And I think there's a lot of people who say who elect somebody or won't even vote, and then they'll blame people in high office and say, well, why aren't they doing what we want? Failing to join in the organizations and failing to be mobilizers and willing to join in, as Mother Teresa or as Susan Anthony, as these people I talked about late before, become citizen leaders in the Thomas Jefferson mold and so on, and writing and speaking out and getting involved. Our system works only if large numbers of people care enough and love their communities enough and their country enough to get involved in different ways. That doesn't mean always joining a political party or writing a letter to the editor, but it includes those things. But it means sometimes rising up around an issue that you care deeply about and organizing a group and marching on City Hall or writing an alternative piece of legislation or writing a book about what the ideal community should be on drugs, on economic development, on environmental matters, whatever it is. There's plenty of room for improvement. And let me just mention about the American political system for a minute. Along the lines that you suggested, there are many things that need improvement. We are a tremendous political system, but we have terrific problems. We don't have many people voting. We have too much campaign corruption in terms of big money influencing votes and who gets elected. We have too many advantages for incumbents. too many incumbents, in my judgment, get elected. We don't have districts that are competitive enough. We have too many advantages that incumbents have voted themselves in terms of free mail. We ought to have a system where it costs members of Congress to write to us and it costs nothing for us to write to them, rather than the vice versa, which is the system that we nonsensically have now. And they send out this campaign literature, which we pay for as taxpayers. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. And we talk about having a free press, but basically it's owned by special interests, too, who argue their points of view. And we need to raise a lot of questions about a system. We have a judicial system that, unfortunately, money counts more than it should. If you have a lot of money, you can afford certain kind of defense counsels as opposed to if you're indigent. We have blemishes in our campaigns. We have overly negative campaigns, campaigns that are overly predisposed or guided by negative short ads and sometimes unfair, mean-spirited kinds of wrong-headed, maybe unethical kinds of advertising. So we have things in this country that need close looking at. All of them, I think, are subject to improvement, and I think that we can make improvements in those areas, but we need not accept the system as it is. And as Eastern Europe and many nations around the world are looking towards making the systems more democratic, we cannot hold our system out as the system that has all the answers. We, too, have got to recognize that we are a developing democracy that's highly unfinished. We've only granted women the right to vote two generations ago. We've only granted blacks really the right to vote one generation ago. Younger Americans were granted the right to vote also only after the Vietnam War. We have registration laws that make it difficult for a lot of people to vote. We need to make it easier for people to vote. We probably need to have fewer elections and encourage turnout. And we need to harness television and radio and newspapers to be a better vehicle to educate people about issues so that we can get thoughtful decisions being made. We have the initiative in referendum and recall in states like Alaska that I use, but too often not enough people fully understand what they're voting on. I happen to favor those issues at the state and local levels, but we need to make sure that they get used in a proper way and that sufficient information is available so that people do know and are not scared off from voting when there are issues like you have in Alaska, whether it's marijuana or moving the state capital or issues like that, which are important issues, and so on. So we have a lot to improve in the way of democracy. America is a many splendid system, but it also splintered, and it has room for improvements that we need to think through. And I think younger people in this country often take our system for granted. They say we have a wonderful two-party system. They don't like the parties very much. They think that democracy is coterminous with two parties. And that's not true. Most nations in the world have either one party or multiple parties. If they're democracies, usually it's multiple parties. We have a presidential congressional system that has a lot of intensity and tension between the two branches. We have two parties in this country that have not done an adequate job of raising issues. I don't think the Democratic Party holds President Bush accountable enough and offers enough opposition. And I think the Republican Party also, with respect to Congress, has a tough time to get good candidates to run against Democrats who are entrenched in the Congress, and there's not enough of a sharpness between the two parties. There needs to be perhaps a little more realignment with Democrats and Republicans opposing each other with more regularity rather than kind of fuzzing over their differences. Americans are unlikely to vote in large numbers until we can get some choices in a variety of campaigns and between what the two national parties are. So I've just kind of thrown out a handful of issues.
Yeah.
That's not to say our system is a terrible, bad system. It's to say that Americans should be proud of what we have achieved, but not complacent, smug, and overly satisfied by a system that is unfinished and needs to go ways further, a long ways further, if we're going to really make this a democratic nation, a democratic republic.
You're listening to Conversations. In case you tuned in after the top of the hour, this is Dr. Thomas Cronin. He is the author, co-author, or editor of 10 books. Some of them are Government by the People, which first came out in 75 and has several printings and updates, the last in 1990. State and Local Politics, also by Prentice Hall, 76 was its first publishing date, and it has had several others, the last being 90. The Invention of the American Presidency in 1989, Rethinking the Presidency in 75 and in 89, and The State of the Presidency also in 75 and in 80. A number of Dr. Cronin's books are used in political science classes in colleges around the country, at least one in any and all of 50 states, right?
Yes. And let me just give a plug for one of my most recent books.
And please.
It's a book, Susan, called Direct Democracy, The Politics of Initiative, Referendum, and Recall. And it's a book that looks at the history of populist democracy, where the people get involved in putting issues on the ballot or recalling public officials, or sometimes putting a law that the state legislature passed but the people don't like and getting enough signatures to vote on whether that should be kept as a law. That's called a referendum process. And in about half of the states in the United States, including Alaska, the American people have the right to get involved in recalling an official before their term is up. And that's happened in Alaska sometimes in school board and borough elections and so on. And a lot of issues have been on the ballot. Not a lot, but occasional issues on the ballot here. And my book looks at the 80 or 90 years of history in the western states and a few eastern states that allow initiatives, referendums, and recalls. And the book's title, again, is Direct Democracy, The Politics of Initiative, Referendum, and Recall. And Harvard University Press published the book. was sold out in hardback, and this is really, I'm sorry for saying this is a kind of commercial,
go ahead.
It's a scholarly book, but it's a book that explains these processes to people, and it's now in paperback, Harvard University Press, and I'm sure it's in the libraries around here, and I brought a couple of copies, in fact, with me on this trip to Alaska to give to people, but people are interested in that process. It's a fascinating, and it relates to what we're talking about, namely mm-hmm. people getting involved. Mm-hmm. And often we've had issues that both conservatives and progressives and liberals have been interested in that have been put onto the ballot and forced officials to and the people to get engaged with. We right now have term limitations around the ballots in many states in our passing. We've had environmental standards and hazardous waste measures and bottle bills and matters of gun control and death penalty and issues that like that have been on the states and taxation formulas and so on have been on the state ballots in a lot of states. We're going to likely see much more of this in the future than we've seen in the past. People sometimes get dissatisfied with the pace of progress from their state legislature. And I know in this particular state of Alaska, there's always a lot of tension between the people and the Juneau legislature and mm-hmm. controversy over issues that arise there. And Alaskans are well known nationwide for being independent and feisty and sometimes irreverent towards their state institutions.
I want to make a turn that is not really a turn. It's still talking about citizen participation. You're an academic who participates in the political process. You've been a White House fellow, White House intern under Bill Moyers, a number of other positions, consultant to government as well. Let me reflect to you a statement that an academician and a journalist made and ask you to critique it for me, if you will. The gentleman's name is Rushworth Kidder. He was writing for the Christian Science Monitor, and he says about academics and public life, somehow we, academics, have constructed a society in which the connections are missing between the age's best minds and its worst problems. Do you agree with that? And if it's so, are we as Americans missing a great source of policymaking in leaving our academicians out?
Well, Susan, that's an interesting quote, and I've often reflected on the separation of brain and state, if you will, which actually is the title that a student of mine who came from Alaska one time suggested to me in a student paper. Separation of brain and state, and what she was writing about and the course was probably about was how intellectuals and people who are scholars and researchers sometimes don't mingle with and have a condescending attitude towards the people in government and vice versa. That there's a separation of the brains of society and the state, meaning the governmental arena, politics. I think there are a lot of people like myself who try to bridge the gap. I've worked in the White House. I've worked in the Senate. I've been an advisor to people in public life. I've been on the national platform committees of my political party. I've run for the United States Congress. I have a lot of friends who are in office. I've been an advisor to governors and cabinet members. Mm-hmm. And I think there are people like myself who in different fields of economics, political science, research, medical fields, health fields, education, try to bridge that gap. I'm not really worried that there is an abyss between the two worlds that cannot be bridged effectively from time to time. But we do need, as a society, when we're funding research in every field of research, to ask about how things can be tied back and brought home in terms of improving public policy and improving matters, whether it's trying to improve crime in the streets or the effectiveness of our justice system or schools or economic development in an intelligent, prudent way. And I think by and large those people who teach in America's colleges and universities and do care about the communities they live in. They have children in the schools usually. They drink the water in their communities. Pollution matters. Economic opportunities matters to them, their students, their families. So I think ultimately that Russ Kidder's comments are provocative, and I've read his works too, and I write for the same magazine, Christian Science Monitor, that he writes for occasionally, and I think they're well stated, but I think they're probably nothing to be really feared about. I think it's important to have people in the universities care about issues. This isn't to say that they should be running for office and so on. There is a different world of being a detached scholar, of trying to break through the research barriers in genetics and biophysics and geophysics, and as people up here at Alaska are well known for in plant biology and particularly in geophysics and some of the scientific institutes that you have up here, terribly important to provide the money and the support and understand that sometimes results and breakthroughs do not come in 1 week or 1 year or 1 decade, and that often the tie-in from basic research to societal breakthroughs is hard to understand and hard to appreciate. That basic research needs to go on in a lot of fields. My own work tends to relate to what's going on in society and government and politics a lot closer. But there's an important realm and world of people doing basic research that and doing things in the arts, in composing and new music and new art, and that doesn't have immediate popularity or immediate tie. But we need to encourage people in all walks of creativity and creative science to do what they do. And I think we need to be careful about saying everything needs to have an immediate relevance. I think one of the reasons why the Academy is often viewed as a separate kind of, sometimes an ivory tower and sometimes detached, and sometimes there's a jealousy of the funds going to institutions of higher education or research in the private or public sectors, we need to have a greater tolerance of the fact that time and resources and independence and time for reflection and time for working on experiments that sometimes don't work out needs to take place before we can have the breakthroughs. The United States has as one of its enormous strengths research in the fields of technology and genetics and medicine and agriculture. We are the world's leading research community. No doubt about it. As you travel around the world looks to the United States for research in dozens of fields. And we can be proud of that. And our system of higher education in the United States, public and private, is superior, without any doubt, to the higher education institutions of the world.
As much as it's criticized.
That's right. We have students from every nation in the world coming to our institutions. And here at the University of Alaska, at your various branches, and particularly here at your major university in Fairbanks, students from all over the world come to this institution and come to my institution and come to Stanford and elsewhere because they know that they can go back to their countries and have opportunities and be exposed to cutting-edge research mm-hmm. in so many different fields. That's important. We need to encourage that. And we need to occasionally celebrate that. I think we take it for granted. I think most Americans do not realize that the higher education institutions in America are as advanced as they are and do as good a job as they do. You don't hear too many high school students yearning to go to universities in France or Japan or China or the Soviet Union, and the students from Africa are not flocking to the Soviet Union or to Brazil. They're flocking to the United States, and that's for a reason, and that is because in engineering and architecture and in medicine and in biology and political science and physics, the United States, by and large, is the leader.
This is Conversations, and you're listening to Tom Cronin. You have described the presidency as an office that is flexible and plastic. It grows in times of crisis and contracts or is forced to contract in time of normalcy. Can you expand on that so that people can understand your perspective?
Yes, the American presidency is an institution which has constitutional origins in the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and the United States Constitution, Article 2, but in many respects, there's a living constitution and a living presidency that contracts and expands depending on who is in the office and depending on the context in which presidents and the country find themselves in. In periods of depressions, recessions, and particularly wartime emergencies and national emergencies, and we turn to the presidency and we allow it to be expanded in terms of its resources and authority. And ask presidents to provide leadership with a capital L.
Take care of this problem. Deal with it.
Mr. President, lead.
Yeah.
Mr. President, we want you to be commander-in-chief in a vigorous way, in a more vigorous way than the predecessor was. And Emergencies alone do not dictate the presidents will be effective. I mean, we have for every Abraham Lincoln, we have a James Buchanan. For every Franklin Roosevelt, we have a Herbert Hoover. So that there's not a direct correlation with problems or emergencies and the fact that they necessarily will lead. Generally, eventually, we have got somebody who comes along. But prior to Abraham Lincoln, we were stumbling through a major, major crisis in this country about racism and black and white relationships in this country, which we had papered over 60, 70 years earlier at the Constitutional Convention, hoping that it would go away.
Solve itself.
And it didn't. And it was the biggest constitutional crisis this nation ever faced. It required a huge, bloody division in this country and war before Lincoln and the country could resolve the crisis.
Is it sometimes the luck of the draw that brings us a Lincoln who says, all right, we'll deal with this? But hard as it will be, bloody as it will be, we will resolve it.
This is part of the mystery of leadership. I think on some issues in some societies, maybe leaders don't come along. Leaders are in many respects shaped by the context and by the people. It's often said by some writers that great times and great crises call forth great leadership, and that it is very difficult to be assessed or perceived as a great leader in the absence of a great crisis. There's a determinism there that's a little bit scary, and it's unclear in my mind of exactly how that works. Can you be, let me put it rhetorically, and kind of just talking out loud with our listeners, can one be a great leader in normal times? And what would that leadership be? Interesting question that I hope people in their living rooms or automobiles will chat about among their friends.
Being a great leader in normal times might mean meddling, getting in the way.
And intrusiveness.
Intrusiveness, yeah.
Or over-regulation, or over this, sure. Or over that. I think there is some truth to the fact that leadership is perceived as great when it has helped us and how, as an agent of ourselves, wrestling with a great problem, whether it's racism, depression, war, or emergencies. And so there's obviously some line of reasoning there. Great leadership, what is it? What is the relationship between creativity and leadership? That's another fascinating question in my mind. Are leaders creative individuals? Are they inventors? Is there a difference? Or are leaders brokers and facilitators in a way? Can you be a leader? That's another question, Susan, for your audience to ponder as they listen to our discussion, to our conversations, if you will. Can one be a great leader if one acts alone? Envision a large arena, let's say an athletic arena in which there are 10,000 seats, and a person is there alone. Nobody else is there. All day, they're there alone. Can they engage in leadership? That's a question. And I have my students wrestle with that question from time to time, and it's kind of intriguing. Well, if they're writing the Declaration of Independence or a letter from a Birmingham jail, or they're writing Uncle Tom's Cabin, or they're writing an Einstein-like formula, could it not be that later on they're able to bring a plan or a manifesto or an equation that triggers all kinds of leadership? They're there alone. But later on, what they're doing there becomes a major triggering event. My own answer to the question is that if they're there alone, that they really can't exercise. They can engage in intellectual thought and conception and research ideas or creative kinds of impulses. But for them to be a leader, they need to be with others and they need to have their ideas accepted by others. And that leadership is an engagement of one individual with groups of individuals, which allow the group to see goals and objectives and to get motivated and mobilized and energized to take on some task or challenge.
Once again, that bubbling up, that percolation process you've talked about.
And that the fact that that leadership is not a solo act, leadership is an engagement, a partnership. Mm-hmm. It's in association with others that I think is crucial.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes with you here at KUAC-FM, and we're talking today with Tom Cronin. Among his awards and honors, he's a member of Pi Sigma Alpha and Alpha Sigma Nu National Honor Societies. He was awarded a National Science Foundation Fellowship and has been a White House Fellow. As well, he has received the Charles E. Merriam Award for significant contributions to the art of government. It was awarded by the American Political Science Association in 1986. You said at a public talk that a democracy, this one perhaps in particular, goes through cycles of public concerns and private interests. It's a nicely illustrative phrase that. Are we in a time of private interests now? I think the underlying that question is a question I've been wanting to ask you. In any case, I'll throw it into the mix. Where do you think we are in terms of this democracy in 1991? Are we going into a trend towards passivity? Are we emerging from a trend of passivity? Are we moving away from personal interests or moving towards greater personal interests?
The United States isn't, in my judgment, as a nation of individuals who really believe in individual rights. We're very suspicious about government. We tolerate government, but we don't enjoy government. We tolerate the public sector, but we don't particularly enjoy it. And I think people in Alaska, from what I understand, and I'm not an expert on Alaska, but from my readings and talking with friends from Alaska and experts in all Alaskan political systems, I gather that people in Alaska tolerate government even less than people in the lower 48 states do, in the sense of suspicion and cynicism, even though they may work for the federal or state or local governments or the public university system. There is a tolerance rather than an enjoyment of government, and that characterized the United States even more than most people in most nations. We don't like bureaucracy. We don't like taxes. And I think we have been in the 1980s particularly symbolized by and illustrated by Ronald Reagan, kind of an anti-government nation, anti-politics almost nation. It's almost as if we wished that government could go away and we could solve our own problems and, you know, give us back our taxes. And we forget about all the services that the government renders, aid to the elderly, to the infirm, to the handicapped, law enforcement systems, research on cancer, and astronaut programs, scientific research, and investments in trying to improve the quality of life, highway systems, airports, and so many things that the government really gets involved in. And we're a little bit hypocritical on that. We take for granted all the services, but we detest government regulation, conscription, the draft, and everything else related to it. We're grateful to George Bush and the military for ending the war, but we wish we could cut the defense budget and be able to take a longer vacation with the monies that we save from not having to pay our taxes here in April. So Americans are really funny about this. I think that we're very caught up with our private opportunities and our private interests right now. We have on occasion, like in the 1930s, like in the populist period roughly around the time Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt were president, when there was concern about the Industrial Revolution and unfair labor practices and so on. And in the 1960s a little bit with the civil rights and environmental and women rights movements, we have on occasion become more public-oriented about the nation as a commonwealth. We have on occasion become more concerned with community, of what we as a community are all about, rather than what I am all about. Studs Terkel, a writer from Chicago, has a little saying that I came across in one of his books, where he says, "I live in a community, and if that community is not in good shape, then neither am I." You know, that's a fascinating, I like that. And I think that's a public regarding sense. That's saying, I live in a community, and I have responsibilities as a member of a larger community. And that's what I mean by public regarding, that if my community and my neighbors and my neighborhood and my city and borough and community are not in good shape, then I have a responsibility too. And I'm not in good shape either. And I've got a responsibility, and I've got to pitch in and help out. And it's not just a matter of having to bury a neighbor or to rebuild somebody's farmhouse that has been burned down. It's a matter of taking a concern about the quality of the infrastructure, the roads and the schools and the bridges and the recreational facilities and the sports and athletic community kinds of things and so on. If we're going to have a healthy society, it requires healthy families, healthy churches and sports programs and schools and activities and job opportunities and so on. And there are in America and particularly in America West, a large number of individuals who kind of want to opt out and want to say, I don't want to be a part of a community. I want to be in my own right. I want to be a rugged individualist. I want to be on the frontier. I want to do my own thing. Don't fence me in. Don't regulate me. Don't tax me. Leave me alone. I want to develop myself, maybe my kids, to the best possible. But and I think we go back and forth between those notions. I think all of us have within us some sense of community. And all of us have some sense of that wanting to be out there on our own and not intruded upon. And American politicians come along and play upon those two themes. When we talked about the Great Society and a war on poverty and women's rights and civil rights, we were in affirmative action, we were talking about the public regarding notion. When we talk about privatizing and contracting out what government does and cutting taxes in half and getting government off of our backs, we're talking about the private interests, if you will. We go through cycles in American politics, and various economists and historians have often documented these cycles. They often go in 20 or 30-year periods. And we're in a period, I think, certainly in the 1980s and maybe in the early 1990s, a period where we're still quite caught up with our private individual interests, I think, more so than ourselves as a community. I think that will change. I don't know when it will change, and I don't know who will be the agent of change. Sometimes wartime situations or bad economic circumstances cause upheavals. Sometimes technological changes bring it about. But there will be a time, I'm sure, in the next decade or so, where we'll be more concerned with community. We'll be more concerned about drugs and crime and education and job opportunities and what the information revolution and the technological revolutions that are now taking in the genetic revolutions that are now taking place, what those disturbances mean in terms of the human condition and ourselves and our neighbors. And maybe we'll say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to pull together. We've got to make some decisions. We've got to take some stands. We've got to invest some resources into things which will benefit the common weal and not just let us all go our own way. We are a community. We are a nation, and so on. Having said that, one fascinating development, Susan, is that the old nation state, as we know it, is withering away slowly. It's not going to fade in our lifetime, but the whole notion of Canada, the United States, Mexico, China, the Soviet Union, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Kuwait, there's an arbitrariness of drawing these lines, and whether it's the sand of the Middle East or the border between Alaska and Canada, that are increasingly irrelevant.
Do you see a global, not a global government necessarily, but a global community?
I don't see a global government, and some of my friends who have been thinking about this, notably somebody like Harlan Cleveland, an elder statesman and writer who I respect a lot, argues that there really are dozens of issues where we have transnational governmental governing arrangements. We have weather satellites that are shared worldwide. We have international conferences on global warming. We have a worldwide preoccupation with the stock markets of the world. We have a worldwide preoccupation with certain issues. We have major treaties and understandings worldwide about, for example, the language, the common language that pilots use when they're coming and going from airports, where English has become the language of pilots internationally. We have major treaties about the laws of the sea and the Arctic and Antarctic, and we have open space treaties now about regulation of outer space and satellites. And we have economies that worldwide, when something happens in Tokyo, it affects us and vice versa. When something happens in the United States, it affects the economy of Latin America. We have labor moving around the world. I don't know, we all learned about all the Palestinians and the Pakistanis who helped to run Kuwait rather than the Kuwaitis, and they all left and made the disturbance. And we have people coming and going worldwide depending on economic opportunities. We have issues, therefore, that know no boundaries. We have a borderless economy increasingly, a borderless information revolution. The reason why, in large part, Eastern European dictators can no longer dictate authoritatively and keep their people submissive was the fax machines and the computers and technology and television made it so that they can no longer keep secrets. And ideas, whether economic or political or ideals about liberty and freedom and equality and justice and about the deficiencies of the communist Marxist system, just spread so rapidly that, that no longer was somebody in a hamlet dependent on information from the political party or mayor person. So we're in an information revolution, a genetics revolution, and a technological revolution that, in a sense, knows no borders. We went from one time of, from a tribal society a few thousand years ago to the city-state. And you had Athens and Venice and Holland and other places, and essentially Philadelphia and Boston, that were city-states. And then countries began to get involved, and you had an England, and you had a France, and you had, in the midst of the Enlightenment period, the United States of America, which had 13 states. And it was a collection of city-states that became, and you had, in a sense, the end of the city-state, which hasn't completely ended, because Singapore and a few places are, Hong Kong, are essentially city-states. But you had the city-state die and the nation-state develop. And that was 200 or 300 years ago. And now we're seeing the nation-state questioned in terms of its ability to subsist independent from things going around worldwide. And whether it's an agreement to wipe out polio, for example, with vaccines, which goes worldwide and happens. And and that's done. And there are medical authorities and treaties and inspection systems and resources that are made available so that the nation, not the nation state, but the world community has wiped out polio. And the world community has made it safe to fly in and out of airports. The world community now has common weather and information. It's absolutely fascinating. Now, I don't envision a global one-world government. I think there's going to be a series. It's going to, Madisonian system will come back again. There'll be a series of different kinds of bodies. The UN will be useful for certain things, and the international weather conferences will be working on other things. International World Health Organizations will work on yet other things. And there will be different bodies that will work on these things, just like OPEC and other cartels have sprung up on oil or other kinds of resources. But it raises questions about whether we and our children are soon to see a transformation of governance on an international level. This whole body of nations coming together to fight Iraq was quite interesting, with 30 nations or so really working together and all kinds of collaborative efforts. The whole notion of governance and leadership is being transformed right before our very eyes, and the whole viability of the nation state is being undermined, and we don't fully grasp that, I don't think. I don't certainly grasp it, and I think we need to.
You've been describing in the last hour what I think must be an almost reluctant democracy here in the United States. We have one. We don't always want to exercise it. We're not always sure we like the power that we put in the hands of our leaders. Feels to me like you're describing a reluctant democracy. If you agree with that, what role does a reluctant and not always coordinated democracy play in this new global picture we've got?
Well,
are we mature enough to be in the world we're living in now?
We have no choice.
Well, I know that, but
we're in it. And,
are we?
We are reluctant to be citizens. We're reluctant to exercise individual leadership. But America is a leader in so many faces. We talked about earlier, in research and in politics and so many other areas, the United States is a world leader. And we have to play a role, a creative role, in working, collaborating on governance systems. But the average person would like to go bowling or watch their kids play sports or go cross-country skiing or go fishing rather than go to public meetings that talk about tough problems and want to pay more taxes for this or that and so on. There is a tremendous temptation to say, let's leave it to somebody else. We can't afford to do that. Everybody has to pitch in some of the time to raise questions about, to keep people in government accountable and to play leadership, societal leadership roles. A lot of leadership that needs to go on in society is not just in government, not just in what we call political leadership. It's It's the leadership of invention, the leadership of ideals, the leadership of example, the leadership of creation and entrepreneurship in the public and private sector. It's leadership of excellence, excellent ideas, excellent ideas, ideals, values. And everyone who's listening to us, Susan, today is capable of being a leader in some way, in some realm. I really challenge everyone listening, what kind of leadership role, you know, can they play, are they playing? My hunch is many of the people listening are leaders of thought, are leaders of example, are leaders in service communities, are leaders in the voluntary sense, trying to make their community, their students, their friends more concerned about what ought to be, what might be, what could be, and talking about what Alaska can become, talking about what America can become, talking about, you know, how we can make this a better world. I'm impressed by younger people wherever I go who care a lot about nutrition and pollution and new ways of eating and living and inventing ways to make this a better society. So I'm an optimist that, yes, we're reluctant, but there's a lot of ingenuity and creativity and talent in this country and in this world. And people want breakthroughs. People want progress.
Is what you've described the issue of our times, the creation of grassroots leadership, is it not the economy, crime, a permanent subculture? It is instead discovering and taking into our hands our own leadership capabilities?
It's terribly important. Yes. Very important.
Thomas Cronin, thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Let me tell people again how they can find your thoughts. The book Thomas Cronin mentioned himself called Direct Democracy and the rest of that title?
Direct Democracy, The Politics of Initiative, Referendum, and Recall. That's a book about populist instruments of democracy, Harvard University Press, published a year ago. And then my major textbook, Government by the People, that is regularly used in colleges and some of the high schools from AP courses. And it's used in all 50 states. I'm very pleased, but just translated into Chinese.
Huh.
And since I've been involved in it, it's sold about 1 million copies. So I'm very proud of the book, Government by the People. It's an introduction to American government at all levels.
Prentice Hall published it. You can
yes.
probably find it at your local university.
At university bookstores, mm-hmm. or you can order it through the university bookstores and college bookstores. Yes, it has copies of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and some of the Federalist Papers, and it has a rich discussion of constitutional principles and interest groups and parties and the Congress and public policy and how where our country has come and so on. I'm very proud of that book.
Good. Also, books you might want to find, Rethinking the Presidency, I had a chance to review last night. It's a very interesting book. You may want to take a look at it. That Little Brown published it in 1975 and then again in 1989. And also The State of the Presidency, also put out first in 75 and then republished in 1980. Thomas Cronin is the president of Cronin Research and Communications, a company he's had and run since 1980. He was educated at Stanford, his MA, two MAs, and a PhD in political science. Currently, he is the visiting scholar at Stanford University Graduate School of Business and the Hoover Institution. He is the McHugh Professor of American Institutions and Leadership at the Colorado College in Colorado Springs. This summer and fall, he becomes the acting president of that institution. And one other thing you might want to take a look at if you are a writer or a teacher or a wannabe in either area, The Right Stuff is a pamphlet that Thomas E. Cronin has written. It's put out by Prentice Hall. Its subtitle, Writing as a Performing and a Political Art. You might want to look it up.
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I hope you'll join us again next week.